Sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam chedevadam. Bottom, there are two mantras. So let's chant Chen Wei Sik's mantra 8 times and then Green Tara's mantra 7 times. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Tadutu Tadutu Re Soha. 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 Now the children are dismissed. They can go to their classes. If your child has never been to a class, please accompany your child and find out where to pick your child up. Today is March 24th, 2013. Sunday teachings with Venerable George Chernoff.
Okay. Good morning. Hey. So nice to be here. I haven't visited the new center before, so it's very nice. Patrick was showing me outside the different classrooms and the children's. I guess you would call it. There's one room that's a play area. Is that right? What do you call it? The nursery. So I was thinking. when I was teaching Lama Ossel some years ago, I heard a story from just before I was teaching him, when he was playing a lot, and his guardian at the time was asking Lama Zopa for some help to try to get Lama Ossel to practice Dharma more. And so Lama Zopa very kindly was requesting, you know, sort of with folded hands, that Lama Ossel, he was a little boy, right, that he practice the Dharma rather than play. And Lama Ossel apparently looked at him quite indignantly and said, "Play is Dharma." So I thought that the nursery, maybe you can think of it as the being in this place close to these holy objects and the spiritual community here. It's kind of their play is Dharma also. So I had the fortune to listen to an MP3 supplied by your spiritual coordinator, Sarah, of Geshe-la's last talk. So I thought I would try to be talking somewhat in the same vein. It sounds like he's teaching some verses, so I don't have access to that particular text, and I wouldn't presume to, continue, and fill in something that he's meant to be teaching, but just talk a little bit about happiness and suffering. I remember, those of you who've known me before, I might have mentioned this story once before, but when I was in England many years ago at Manjushri Institute, which was a FPMT center at the time up in the north of England, a family invited me out to lunch at their house. They'd made this, the mother, the wife, had made this delicious, wholesome meal. It was piping hot on the table. And their kids, I think there were two boys. They were like 6 and 7, something like that, or 5 and 7. And mom was trying to get them, entice them to the table. And they were pulling, mom was trying to pull them this way, and they were pulling this way. And they had spied underneath the sofa some little candy. In Italy, they call them chiclets. I think in America, chiclet is a kind of gum, isn't it? We still have, but just like Lifesaver or something. And from my point of view, it wasn't even red, like yellow or green or something. I like red better. And it was in the dust underneath the sofa, but they had their eyes on this red, and mom was trying to pull them over to the good meal, and I thought, this is very much like the Buddhas and the Bodhisattva situation with us sentient beings. We're fascinated with some icky, picky, teeny, weeny, trivial kind of what we consider to be pleasure, like this, you know, in the dust under the sofa. And the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are trying to encourage us over to have the nice wholesome meal of the Dharma, which will really is what we really want. Actually, we may not recognize it, but what we really want is real happiness, Dharma happiness. We want something which is long-lived, something that is very deep and satisfying. That's what's in, and when we say, you know, the four immeasurables, and we talk about it. All living beings want to have happiness and the causes of happiness. All sentient beings, all sentient beings want to be happy and to be free of suffering. And so we pray. We pray. May they be endowed with happiness and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering and so forth. But because our minds are so caught up in the what we believe, the reality of the appearance of this life, so vibrant, like neon signs, you know, tempting us, that we don't put our energy into, and for some time, into finding real happiness, into finding Dharma happiness. This is interesting. It's like in the theaters where the ushers are bringing down the seat. There's a seat in the first row. So, yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about something I've thought about in this regard. So, you know, Lord Buddha taught the first sermon that he gave, the first teaching that he gave to his fellow disciples, fellow companions that had meditated with him for 6 years. He traveled from Bodh Gaya after achieving enlightenment, and he taught them what has become known as the Four Noble Truths, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And he said, this is suffering. From some accounts I've read, he's pointed to himself. And it's often the case in textbooks that are talking about Buddhism, sometimes high school textbooks or college textbooks, written by people that are maybe academics, it almost sounds like the authors think this is a rather trivial statement, that the Buddha was pointing out the obvious, that there's suffering in the world, you know, headaches and pain and death and sickness and aging and so forth. All the various things that we see. But when the Buddha was pointing to himself, his body, he was kind of indicating that our whole samsaric existence is of the nature of suffering. This Sanskrit word, dukkha. Have you ever heard that word? Dukkha. Sometimes people translate it as unsatisfactory. So maybe a little bit like, yeah, maybe you can call it that way. So he was saying that all of our samsaric existence is unsatisfactory. Not just the obvious suffering, but even that which we call happiness in the ordinary sense. Samsaric happiness. Worldly happiness. Like that chiclet underneath or that little lifesaver, faded, dusty under the sofa. Our samsaric happiness is somehow not going to really satisfy us the way that we hope. The Buddha called samsaric happiness what we call also contaminated happiness. Have you heard that expression? Contaminated happiness? The sense of being experienced by a mind that's still contaminated by a sense of ego identity and grasping to some truth, that this is real, happiness, believing that. The Buddha called this kind of happiness changeable suffering. And there are various commentaries that I've read in Western literature about this. Sometimes people seem to think that it's simply a matter that the fact that the happiness that we experience eventually changes and eventually becomes suffering if you wait long enough. Have you heard that? But one of the great disciples of Nargarjuna, Aryadeva, is one of the great Mahayana teachers of the very early days of the spread of Mahayana. Aryadeva wrote in a text that he composed, that, in fact, there's one chapter that His Holiness says is sort of like the source material for understanding changeable suffering, contaminated happiness. That it's actually the nature of suffering. In there, Aryadeva points out that what we consider to be samsaric happiness, it's not simply that it will eventually change into suffering, but from the very moment we experience it, it's unsatisfactory. It's dukkha. If you wanted to say it's suffering, it's of the nature of suffering. Like, for instance, if you take a poison as a medicine, there's some kinds of poisons. We'll ask our doctors here. What's the classic ones? You might take a poisonous substance to alleviate some...
Digitalis.
Okay. I'll try to say it with a southern accent. Digitalis. You might take that think, well, this is good. I don't have any problems right now, but this is supposed to be the best medicine for the heart. Maybe it'll make my heart better, but it would, if you took enough of it, I presume it would poison you, perhaps kill you. From the very moment you're taking it, even if you had symptoms that it was curing, those symptoms might be reduced, but the suffering of digitalis would be going up at the same time. The unsatisfactory nature of that substance, because it itself is not a source of what we could call Dharma happiness. Do you know the classic example that the Buddha gave of this changeable suffering in the time of the Buddha? When you're outside and it's really hot under the Indian sun, you might think, oh boy, it would be nice to sit in the nice cool shade. So you'd seek out, under some big tree. The suffering of heat would go down, but the suffering, the discomfort of coolness would be rising while the bigger suffering is still going down. We call that situation, that relief, we call that happiness. Oh man, this is great. Until after, some time, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour or something, you're in the shade, and the suffering or the discomfort of the cool exceeds the discomfort of the heat. And then we, shivering a little bit, and we say, oh, let's go sit in the nice warm sun. And the situation reverses. When you get out in the sun, the suffering of the heat begins to increase, the discomfort, the dukkha of the heat, and the suffering of the cool begins to go down. While the bigger suffering is still going down, we call that happiness. Basically, it's just relief. And then when the one that's going up actually exceeds in intensity, the other one, we recognize it as obvious suffering, suffering of suffering. So from the very moment we experience samsaric happiness, it's no more than relief. It's not what we really want. We'd really like, maybe sometimes we want relief, obviously, for something that's bad. Relief. Relief would be good enough. It's hard enough to find relief, right? But what we really long for in the long term, what we really like is real happiness, something that is positive from its own side. But we'll never find that within cyclic existence, within the happiness that we can encounter within cyclic existence. That's why it's difficult. It's difficult for beings like ourselves that are so accustomed to going along with the appearance of this life, for us to change our ways and to forego seeking that samsaric happiness, forego that, what's the word, not prolong, when you, something gratification, delay gratification, is that the right word, or is another word? We consider that a sign of maturity for ordinary worldly events, right? If a person, when they're a teenager, they want to be going out with the guys and the gals for fun, but if they're if they've been tutored by their mom and dad, their parents or their teachers and so forth, now is the time that postponing the gratification, that's the word, postponing the gratification and working now on your studies, later you'll have a greater pleasure. You'll have a job. You'll be able to have a nice income. Whereas if you just engage in the, you know, the immediate gratification, seeking immediate gratification, you won't encounter that. It will be much more difficult later. We consider that a sense of, you know, a sign of maturity in the world. So in the Dharma sense, too, that might be an interesting way for you to think about this. The things that we often spend our time on in the world that bring us some gratification, first of all, it doesn't bring us real happiness. It's no more than the reducing of one suffering, replacing it with another. So this situation just goes back and, you know, back and forth. It's not what we really long for. What we really long for is something that will take some time to achieve. The Dharma happiness, real happiness, starts small and increases over time. It doesn't come out, you know, it's not like eating a piece of chocolate or having an embrace of a lovely person that might bring some immediate kind of fluorescent-like relief or happiness or gratification. Dharma happiness starts small, and we have to have a certain amount of faith to postpone our gratification, to follow that spiritual path. Christianity also, that's a tenet in Christianity also, to have faith that what you're doing will bring some greater relief or happiness later, right? And in Buddhism also, we have the example of great beings like His Holiness, your teacher Geshe-la. Those, sometimes by seeing that example and other practitioners, other teachers at the center who've found some kind of inner calm and happiness, that can give us the inspiration while we're still trying to understand the Dharma to practice it, to find real, long-lived, substantial happiness, Dharma happiness. Now, I notice in one of the talks that I was listening to, that Geshe gave, he was talking about how desire was actually suffering, something to that effect, right? Have you thought about that? What do you think? I'll act as the devil's advocate here, okay? Do you know what that means? I'll act as the devil's advocate and say, a desire is not suffering. Desire can be the cause of suffering. What do you think about that? You know, if you desire something, well, let's say, I'm acting as a devil's advocate. If you desire something and your desires are fulfilled, how is that suffering? If your desires are not fulfilled, the desire becomes also a cause of suffering. So what do you have to say? Who's going to refute this devil? Yeah.
When Geshe-la was talking about that idea that desire, I think what he said is quoting something that said the desire for happiness in this life is suffering. Mm-hmm. What it made me think is if you're in the moment that your mind is desiring something, you're not content with your current situation. So that desire itself is creating the discontent, and that mind of discontent is in itself suffering.
Right. But then I said it's the cause of suffering. So you didn't refute that part.
I
said it's not suffering. Desire itself is not suffering. It's the cause of suffering. So you were just reaffirming what I said. I'm not saying that's... I'm acting as a devil's advocate.
I was thinking in terms of the actual state of mind that is experiencing that desire, that the desire itself in your mind is suffering.
Desire itself is a mental factor, but it's distinct from the mental factor feeling, which is experiencing suffering. So the whole mind, the whole primary mind is experiencing suffering at that point, the whole mind. But the desire is not called suffering, because it has a particular definition that's aiming, you know, thinking about something and wishing to attain it. Okay. Well, I think still desire is suffering, because when Geshe had mentioned at least in the parts that I was listening to, he said that he wasn't talking about this third type of suffering at the moment. Have you heard of the three types of suffering? Suffering of suffering, changeable suffering, which we're talking about here that we often refer to as samsaric happiness, and all pervasive compounded suffering. All pervasive suffering. So merely having a mind that is not yet free of ego grasping, merely having the continuity of a body, let's say, and desires and so forth that have been preconditioned by ignorance and are susceptible in any one moment, in the next moment, to developing either suffering of suffering or changeable suffering, all of those situations are unsatisfactory. They're dukkha. The Buddha said that suffering of suffering is recognized as unsatisfactory, as suffering, by animals, by anyone. Everyone recognizes a headache or being stuck with a thorn or being hungry or having your limbs cut off as suffering. But changeable suffering, to recognize changeable suffering, samsaric happiness, as not the real thing, is actually the nature of suffering. To recognize that is something that is privy to the human realm. Humans are capable of understanding that, whereas other beings, animals, very difficult. Maybe some imprint, if they were, as a human, had thought of this before. Humans can understand the changeable suffering, that samsaric happiness is of the nature of suffering, is unsatisfactory, and therefore postpone the gratification, you know, the desire to have that. You know, they can grasp less to it because they can understand that that's of the nature of suffering. But this third kind of suffering, subtlest suffering, all pervasive, compounded suffering, merely having a body and mind that was thrown, so to speak, by karma and delusion. Does that make sense to you? Thrown? You know what I mean? We say throwing karma. Merely having a body and mind that's thrown by our past actions, our karma, and our delusions, that is of the nature of suffering. That it's not something that we can understand it intellectually as ordinary humans, but to really get a feeling of the reality of that, it's said that only the Arya beings have a real, what would you say, visceral understanding of that. Have you heard this? You've heard this before, right? No? No. So, for some of you who haven't, if you were to take a hair, like a dog hair, put it in the palm of your hand and roll it, or very thin hair, roll it on, better, thin hair, baby hair, roll it on your hand, and I ask you, is that suffering? Nah, come on, it's nothing. Especially if you're macho, right? Nothing. No suffering whatsoever. But if you were to take that hair and put it in your eye, or press it against your eyeball, you suddenly recognize, oh no, that's, I don't like that, that's, you'd recognize that as suffering. So it's said that we, ordinary beings who haven't realized the Four Noble Truths, haven't realized emptiness, our perception of all pervasive suffering is kind of like the hair in the palm of your hand. You know, we notice it. We intellectually, we can perceive it, but we don't recognize it as uncomfortable. We're not constantly itchy, saying, oh gosh, I still have this contaminated body and mind. This is unsuitable. This is unsatisfactory. But the Arya beings, those who've first had an insight into emptiness, realized the Four Noble Truths, they recognize this situation because of their insight into reality. They experience the situation that we're experiencing now as totally unsatisfactory, as dukkha, as all-pervasive compounded suffering. Because merely having desire, let's say, in the mind that has been preconditioned by ignorance and so forth, that was thrown by that, the continuity of our deluded aggregates, itself is suffering. So I wanted to go... I played the devil's advocate before. I just wanted to slay that devil before you, so you didn't think I was saying that desire wasn't suffering. But in a certain sense, if you just talk about changeable suffering, cause and effect, desire is a cause of suffering. It might be simultaneous once, if it's not fulfilled, with a suffering feeling. But even we can begin to recognize in our mind the presence of desire as something that's unsettling. You know, and that itself is a definition, kind of one of the defining characteristics of what we call the delusions, or klesha, is an Indian word, klesha. Have some of you studied, or does Geshe-la mention the Sanskrit words sometime, or the Tibetan words? Mm-hmm. Yeah, klesha or nyonmong. Actually, generally, desire might not, depends on what you mean by desire. Generally, desire might not be the word that we'd use to categorize a delusion, a klesha. There are some desires that are beneficial. Like, say, for instance, the desire to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Do you have any idea what that state of mind might be called? Do you know what that means? Someone might call that bodhicitta. Bodhi means enlightenment or awakening. Citta means mind, right? The mind that's possessed by a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a courageous being that's aiming for bodhi. So they have a desire. So is that delusion? Is that a klesha, that desire? We have to be careful. We might, in our own mind, we might have heard from certain teachings that the Buddha taught, maybe some people translating Theravada teachings might say, the root of samsara, the root cause of samsara is desire, or craving. And then you'd be led to the conclusion that bodhicitta is a deluded state of mind, because it's the desire to achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. So there's a little bit of difference here. Desire itself, or aspiration, let me translate it that way, is a state of mind which has a goal and wants to achieve it. It can be disturbing. If it has exaggerated the qualities of what you desire, and in exaggerating those qualities, starts to get that itchy feeling, I gotta get that, you know. Oh man, that new MacBook, that new iPhone, or, you know. We were talking in the car coming over, the new, what was it, Hannah? Tesla. Have you heard of the Tesla car, the electric car? Oh man, I'd like to get that. Oh. Wow, electric car. No more gas. You know, it's quiet. The mind thinking about the so-called qualities of the car. 0 to 60 in 6 seconds, you know. This kind of thinking is what is, you could translate this as inappropriate attention. Inappropriate attention. Sumin yila chepe. Sumin or inappropriate means paying attention to something in a way which is instigating the delusions. Okay, you know, you see someone at Starbucks or where do you go here in town? Pizza place or something. You're having meal and you see something. Oh, nice looking guy, nice looking gal. ooh, you know, nice shape, nice complexion, young, yeah, prosperous, what's the word, free, single, unaccompanied at least. So the mind starts to elaborate like this. This is what this is not Dharma attention, not paying attention. Paying Dharma attention, we say, sentient being, suffering, nature of suffering, would not bring me ultimate satisfaction. Impermanent, changing, aging at this very moment. Very instant aging. Of course, that doesn't bring us the gratification that we have come to expect in the world. But that might be, in a long term, that might be worth alternating once in a while when you start to engage in inappropriate attention. You know, the Tesla car, 60, 0 to 60. Yeah, and to think of all of the Dharma truths of that. It's impermanent. If I had it, I wouldn't really be happy. If I owned it, there would be the fear of it being stolen or scratched, or what's the word, keyed? Do you call that? You know, someone might be incensed that I bought this expensive car in the parking lot, put a, you know, and then I would be upset. All sorts of shortcomings. All sorts of, that would be paying Dharma attention. So, with Dharma attention, free of inappropriate attention, our desires possibly would be more limited to things that would really be wholesome. You know, with an actual Dharma attention. And so, for instance, to desire liberation. Do you know the there are two goals in the Buddhist pantheon, ultimate goals, one of which is called tarpa, or liberation, moksha. I didn't say mocha, moksha. And bodhi, enlightenment. Moksha also is called nirvana. You've heard of that, that's generally we say in the Buddhist sense. That's the goal of the Hinayana path. So to desire nirvana, to desire liberation, that's the usual word that's along with tarpa, with liberation. There's a Tibetan named Tardo. There was a Geshe who lived many years in Charlottesville, Geshe Tardo. I don't know if any of you ever heard of him or encountered him. That's the word, desiring liberation. Tarpa means liberation. De means to desire. So that is not something which is considered to be a bad desire. Like the desire in bodhicitta that's desiring enlightenment, that's a desire that's not causing the mind to become disturbed. It's not based on an inappropriate attention. It is possible to desire liberation or to desire enlightenment, to desire to achieve enlightenment, for infantile reasons, thinking, if I was enlightened, I would really be able to put Don Brown down, or, you know, I would be the smartest one. Other people would pay it, you know, they would bow to me, and I would know other people's minds. And you could have all sorts of infantile, deluded reasons for desiring enlightenment, but in bodhicitta, it's one that has been, that desire for enlightenment has been engendered, has been created out of a sense of compassion for living beings. That has to precede this desire for enlightenment, which is concurrent with bodhicitta. Sensing the suffering of living beings, all living beings, even your enemies, and wanting them to be free. Sensing their changeable suffering and wanting them to be free from that. You know, like the kids, they wanted to have the chiclet under the table, the lifesaver under the sofa in the dust. Mom was trying to take them to the other one. So they were thinking, Mom is being really unreasonable. She doesn't want us to be happy. You've probably, some of you who have kids probably have encountered that to kids and say, you don't want me to be happy? You know, you want them to have a better happiness, a higher happiness. But they're intent on this, something that's going to maybe cause them some problems. So the compassion that precedes the desire for enlightenment in bodhicitta is one that understands the suffering of sentient beings, but their changeable suffering, and thinks that's not enough. It's okay, sometimes relief. I want them to have some relief, but that's not enough. I want them to have the real wholesome meal, not to be satisfied with this icky-picky relief. That's not real happiness. And also recognizing even beings that are experiencing high, elevated states of concentration, the form and formless realms, who are not yet, who have not yet realized emptiness, whose minds maybe are not experiencing suffering of suffering, or even changeable suffering, not a blissful state, but just neutral feeling, they too, you know, are still caught in samsara, wishing them to be free of that contaminated continuity of their aggregates. So preceded by that, and weighing what's the best way to bring about alleviation of their suffering, recognizing that, you know, we can give them what's the famous thing? A fish. What is it, you know, the expression, or is it a bread? Give a man a fish, they teach a man to fish. He's right. Give a man a fish, he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, he eats for life. Something like that. So if I could teach people how to, you know, separate themselves from suffering perfectly, how they could achieve liberation and enlightenment, that's the best way to alleviate their suffering. Otherwise, it's just going to be suffering this lifetime. I teach them how to get a job, I educate them, or I alleviate their suffering. I'm a chiropractor, I can, you know, help their back pain, or a physician, or maybe physicians don't like to hear that chiropractors can help. I heard sometimes physicians are, chiropractic is no good. You know, whatever you can do this lifetime, that's wonderful, but it's not the ultimate way to alleviate people's suffering, because they're going to have back pains in the future, they're going to have to find jobs again in the future, they're going to need food again in the future. The best way to help sentient beings is to teach them the path to enlightenment. So then thinking, wow, I must achieve enlightenment. You know, that would, and then would weigh in their mind, can I achieve enlightenment? You would look at the teachings of the Buddha, investigate your own mind, recognize the Buddha nature within us, the emptiness of the mind, the nature of our mind is empty of true existence, and that we have the potential, the clear light nature of the mind to eliminate all the obstacles, to develop all the good qualities. When you've investigated all of this and come to the conclusion, not only is it possible, it's something I have to do, when that thought rises, that desire for enlightenment, that's much different than the desire for chocolate, you know, or desire for peanut butter, or, you know, desire for the Tesla car, or that I long for. This is not a deluded desire. So the desire that brings, that is the deluded desire is, you know, desiring for the happiness of this lifetime. That's what Geshe-la was saying, right? It's a desire for, say, I remember hearing on the Sadi, this lifetime. That kind of desire alone, although we need relief occasionally, you know, go for it, you know. Go for it once in a while. The pizza. Don reminded me that one of the times I was here before, when I mentioned my secret fantasy of, you know, what I considered real pleasure was stracciatella gelato. Have you ever had stracciatella? You know, stracciatella. It's not just ordinary chocolate chip ice cream. They shave off the chocolate, you know, like those things you cut the cheese with, and that's mixed. Oh, just, you know. So my my fantasy of real happiness is a huge refrigerated swimming pool filled with stracciatella and big gates around it to keep the rest of you out. So I have it all to myself. But then when you think about it, you know, the first couple of bites of stracciatella, the suffering of being hungry or the chemical reaction that I experience is pleasant, that suffering begins to go down and the suffering of stracciatella goes up. After a certain amount of time, if I keep on eating for, in my case, probably 20 minutes or an hour, I would recognize, you know, the suffering of stracciatella now becomes obvious. All of the samsaric substances or situations, praise, reputation, wealth, all of them are of the nature of suffering. That even if I desire them, you know, desiring for the happiness of this life means desiring these kinds of things that won't ultimately bring me happiness. And that causes my mind to be disturbed. That becomes then a delusion, especially if I engage in inappropriate attention and my desire becomes more intensified in what we call attachment. Dupa in Tibetan means desire. Can be kind of like the aspiration. Can be good or bad in general. But duchak is a Tibetan word for I can't remember the Sanskrit, maybe you know, for attachment, longing desire, kind of because of perhaps inappropriately thinking about things, wanting to get them, intensifying it. If I had that, I'd really be happy. And then, you know, the mind becoming tense, that itself, that experience, the presence of that klesha, that particular desire now is overtly suffering because it's disturbing the mind. We can even experience that when you're say with the object of desire, not even wanting to maybe open it up because it's, you know, it's so perfect, you know, or whatever. So I think you're very lucky to have an experienced teacher like Eshagelek to talk about these things slowly with you, for you yourself to think about them again. I myself remember my teachers, Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when we were studying the basic Lama Rim teachings in the 70s at Kopan. Every year we were hoping there'd be higher and higher teachings, you know, and there'd be another Lama Rim course next year. And I, what's this? We studied last year. And Lama Zopa would say, until you've realized this material, and until you've internalized it, until it's become, you know, part of your mind and experience, you have to hear it again and again. The great lamas that we respect and admire, great beings, meditators, they themselves long to hear the Lan Rim again and again, the stages of the path. To hear it in various different ways. This Geshe is providing you in a very tasty sort of, what would you call, fast food, you know, ready to eat. Not fast food in the negative sense, but, you know, ready to consume. You don't have to prepare it so much. You can just think about what he's saying. And sometimes the Tibetan lamas, they would, In mentioning about their own experience, they would say how many times they'd heard discourses on the Lan Rim, not the praise, not to sort of, I've heard 500 lectures, you know, like sometimes we talk, I've got this initiation, that initiation. Have you ever heard, maybe you've done or you've heard people say a little bit boasting or something or inflating their own mind? But here, not for that purpose, but to try to encourage students to recognize the importance of hearing the teachings. One of my teachers, Geshe Rapton, who passed away many years ago, he said that, and he was recognized, he was a what they call a senshab of the Dalai Lama. That's sometimes translated as debating partner or tutor or something like that. Senshab. Sen is maybe can be short for seni, means debate or philosophy. Shab means is either honorific or feet. So it can mean at whose feet you study philosophy, sort of like the tutor. And that could be translated as tutor of the Dalai Lama. So Geshe Rabtan was a great scholar and meditator, tantric meditator, and people would come to him for advice about tantra and these higher things. And when he mentioned once, I think in his biography or a text he wrote about the songs of his experiences, he mentioned that one of the regrets he had about this life was that there were some days after he'd begun to study the Dharma, there were some days when he didn't meditate on the Lan Rim because he was busy. And these basic things, you know, the truth of suffering, like, you know, Geshe was talking about, and the fact that samsaric happiness, the wish for samsaric happiness is suffering. There were some days that, you know, he's so caught up in other things or maybe doing tantric rituals or some kind of meditations, he didn't think about these other meditations. These are the meditations. These are the thoughts that are like nectar that when your mind is turbulent, you know, like boiling water, pouring in this cooling nectar of the Dharma, reminding, everything's okay. I've got a perfect human rebirth, you know. Doesn't matter my, you know, these bills or these problems or this, you know, these bad words. I'm going to die anyway. I can't take those things with me. Actually, this is good. My, you know, someone criticized me. My negative karma has gone down. If I don't get angry about it, my bank account of negative karma won't increase. And actually, I'll create some virtue, you know, by patiently enduring this, seeing it as the exhaustion of my past, you know, the results of my past negative deeds. This is what can, these kinds of realizations, understandings, are what can really, you know, soothe the sufferings of cyclic existence. This is what can bring about this kind of relief. This kind of understanding is what we call Dharma happiness. So, say for instance, you've got some suffering, and the way that you think to alleviate it, you know, desire, stracciatella, you know. So my first thing is to seek stracciatella to relieve that itch, that longing, right? The desire. Ah, wow. And then always suffering. The Dharma method is to meditate. Not to encounter some samsaric substance or situation that by its very nature is not going to be satisfying, but through meditation to cause that desire to go down. Even if I had stracciatella, I wouldn't really be happy. Although it's hard to believe sometimes for me. You know, there are the chance of, while seeking stracciatella in my car, I could have an accident, I could die and lose this perfect human rebirth. All, you know, all, to meditate in this way, and the desire for stracciatella goes down. You know, if today I don't have stracciatella and I wake tomorrow, will I basically feel different, that I'd miss something today? That's helpful for me. You know, if I just postpone that seeking that samsaric happiness or relief, or, you know, the embrace of another person, or, you know, chasing after some recognition or being right. If I postpone that samsaric episode, tomorrow will I feel deprived? No. We may have some momentary satisfaction when we win an argument, when we get something that we want. You know, you have some momentary satisfaction after the meal. Oh, that was good. Yeah? That was really good. That was satisfying. You might even remember it tomorrow. Wasn't that a good meal? But the next day, there's no satisfaction. Remembering back that meal the next day, does that alleviate your hunger the next day? or at the time of death, all of the things that you won, all of the things, all of the samsaric pleasures that you had, is that going to be satisfying at that time? We're not Frank Sinatra. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. You know? There's a song that I remember him, that I often associate with him. Yeah, My Way. It's My Way or the Highway. No, it's talking about all the things that happened in life, but I had it my way. And so as though in his old age, it's not talking about the time of death, but like he's growing old and there's some satisfaction I had it my way. Maybe for some people, maybe for Frank Sinatra, that brought some satisfaction. And maybe for many sentient beings, samsaric sentient beings like ourselves, that's all the pleasure that they can hope for, the memories of this lifetime. Not the rejoicing in their Dharma practice. That would be from a Dharma practitioner's point of view. They say, I had it my way, I practiced Dharma, even though there were a lot of sufferings. We could rewrite that, I think that would be good. Rewrite that from a Dharma point of view instead of Frank Sinatra. You can sing that to Geshe-la for the Christmas play or something like that. At the time of death, rejoicing about that would be worthwhile. But because that's something we can take with us. In the meditations, what is our? Oh, thank you. And it even says 11:40. This is a no-brainer. Thank you. It's very kind. It says 11:40. It's 11:31. So in the meditation on death and impermanence, is called the 9-round meditation on death. Maybe some of you are familiar. One of the third main outline is called, at the time of death, the only thing that helps is the Dharma. Some of you have heard of that. Some of you may not have heard that before. That means, we can try to, your body doesn't help at the time of death. The thing that you've welcomed as a source of pleasure that is able to ingest the stracciatella or embrace the loved ones or whatever, that fails you at the time of death. Your friends, your relatives, they fail you at the time of death. They can't help you at the time of death. Your wealth, your possessions, you can't take. Only the Dharma can help. So what does that mean? The only thing that helps is to take a Dharma text and put it on your head at that time, or the only thing that helps is for someone to read you something in Tibetan that you don't understand. Some Dharma text to say, this is the holy Tibetan Book of the Dead. That's not what's meant by what helps at the time of death. Only thing that helps at the time of death is Dharma. A couple of different meanings. One is the state of mind at the time of death. Because you have cultivated throughout your life the practice of Dharma, you can die peacefully, even blissfully, rejoicing about the virtues that you've created, practicing the five forces at the time of death, giving away your belongings so you don't die with attachment, making prayers to never be separated from the Dharma in future lives. You can die in a very blissful state of mind. So that's one sense of what Dharma helping at the time of death. It's not something that you can just be naughty from now on until death, and then at that time practice the Dharma. It's going to be very difficult. A friend of mine in India, Dr. Karan Singh, he's a famous, his father had been the Maharaja of Kashmir, Jammu, and Ladakh. So he was in the Indian government, and at one point he asked me to teach him meditation. So I was teaching him about compassion, one meditation, and afterwards he was looking kind of like he'd eaten a prune or a lemon or something. After, I said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "I don't want to think about this now. At the time of death, I'll decide whether to come back or not out of compassion. I don't want to think about it now." And I thought, well, if you don't think about it now, how are you going to be familiar with it at the time of death? If you don't think about the Dharma now, how are you going to have a Dharmic mind at the time of death? So that's what can help. Also, what can help at the time of death is the Dharma that you've practiced in the past, the karmic imprints in your mind, the diminishing of the negative karma and the good virtuous karma that you've created, that is what you can take with you at the time of death. You can't take any of your possessions. Your friends cannot join you, even if you hold hands and jump off, you know, the building together as a suicide or whatever. They may go a completely different place, you know, with you. They can't travel with you. What can travel with you are the imprints in your mind, the karmic imprints, also the karmic imprints of the virtuous states of mind, the realizations that you had. You know, the sense of compassion and loving kindness and patience and perseverance. These imprints can go with you. That can help you at the time of death. Let me see. I'm not sure if there's some time that's meant for questions anyway, but does anyone have any comment or question? Yes. What's your name?
David. It seemed to me, you know, throughout your talk, you kept doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So is the path of the Dharma, is it preconditioned with equanimity?
Well, this well, you know what I was talking about here. I wasn't just sort of...
So it's all, you can study the Dharma in a manically obsessive way.
Yeah, definitely.
And so you have to carry along the equanimity, and so the equanimity is part of the journey. You have to walk the path with the equanimity.
Right. But what I was referring to here was what we call happiness is merely the diminishing of the bigger suffering, replacing it with a lesser one. When that situation, while that is going on, we call that happiness. It's no more than relief, if you think about it.
Right.
You know, embracing Richard Gere. It used to be, now I think for the ladies, you'd have to say Justin Timberlake or someone else. You know, once in Tokyo, I said, imagine embracing Richard Gere. And in the back, I heard, yeah. But, or, you know, for guys, imagine. So that at first it might feel pleasurable, but after an hour or so, 2 hours, you're sweating, your arms are aching. Richard has got bad mouth smell and everything like that. That's what I'm talking about. That it changes into suffering. I wasn't saying that you shouldn't practice in a equanimous way, but in fact, like I said before, you should go for it once in a while. Go for Richard Gere. Go for the stracciatella. But think about it at that time and ask yourself, is this real happiness? I remember Lama Yeshe saying once when he was talking about people going to nightclub to dance, which generally, wouldn't be recommended by Buddhist monks or something. And Lama said, go for it. But he didn't use that word, that phrase, go for it, but something equivalent. But he said, but be mindful at that time. Is this real happiness? And that can be very helpful. At that time when you really feel the urge, just with conscientiousness, watching the mind experience that, do your experiment, real life experiment.
Equanimous mind to do that.
No, I'm not sure what is the thing that you're wondering about here. Equanimous mind in what sense?
So to be objective, mm-hmm. Not be caught up in the experience.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, even while, if you go to the discotheque or you're eating the food or whatever, there's going to be a certain amount of letting go in order to see what the experience is like. But watching the mind at that time, is this real happiness? Am I getting what I really long for? Will I be happy in the long term? Analyzing in these different ways, that might be worthwhile if you were caught up into that. Okay. Anyone else have a Mr. Brown? Dr. Brown.
Hi.
so then you're talking about at the time of death, the only thing that's, you know, there's nine steps, and the only thing that benefits you at the time of death is Dharma practice.
Is the Dharma.
Mm-hmm. Then the conclusion is, I must practice the Dharma purely.
I must practice now. Only the Dharma.
Yeah, only the Dharma, mm-hmm. and practice it purely now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So what is pure Dharma practice?
Well, in these three main outlines, the first outline, the time, death is definite, so I have to practice the Dharma. Time of death is uncertain, so I have to practice the Dharma now. At the time of death, the only thing that helps is the Dharma. I'm going to die for sure, so therefore, I should only practice the Dharma. What does that mean? It means, was it David? David's saying, that sounds unequanimous. You know, only, you know, some of the, like we imagine the white-faced nun that taught us in grammar school, you know, I mean, only practice the Christianity or Catholicism or Dharma or whatever. It sounds unreasonable, you know. But what that means is turning our attention inward and watching, whether you're driving the car or typing or in a business meeting or cooking the meal, whatever, watching your mind occasionally. Of course, you have to be careful not that while you're cutting the vegetable, not thinking at the Dharma chopping your fingers off, but you have to watch. But watching your mind, why am I doing this? What's my goal in life? To be practicing the Dharma all the time. Our teacher, I say Don and I, probably many of you, Lamasopa Rinpoche, I remember an early meditation course at Kopan, he said, people like me, putting himself down, this is, you know, humility. He said, people like me think the practice of Dharma is doing some sadhana. You know, we get up in the morning, we say, excuse me, dear, I'm going to practice the Dharma. So we do our sadhana, we say prayers, crying or whatever, and chanting. And then afterwards, we think we're not practicing Dharma. That was our Dharma practice. Lama Zopa said, the great beings, great practitioners, practicing Dharma all the time, you know, in everyday life. Even in words, you know, walking down the steps, like this, may I be willing to experience suffering, going to the lower realms for the sake of sentient beings. As you're sweeping the floor, just like this, may I eliminate the delusions from the minds of all sentient beings, just as I'm sweeping up this dust. You know, many different ways of thinking. So there's a way of integrating the Dharma in our everyday life so that you're practicing only the Dharma, you know, or becoming more and more that, and more that direction. And as time progresses, it doesn't seem unequanimous. It doesn't seem to be too extreme. I remember the Lama that I mentioned to you before, Geshe Rapton, a great, great teacher. There was a group in London, Sangha Rashita, I'm not sure what were they called, the Friends of the... Do you remember that? Some Theravada, a very successful group for a long time. Sangha Rashita was a British guy who had become a Theravada monk for many years. And they were criticizing... They had a review of Geshe-la's book, and the reviewer was criticizing Geshe-la as being over the top, kind of like, to, you know, Geshe-la, even when he was eating, he was memorizing, reading texts and things like that. Like, oh, this is too much, you know. But maybe to someone who's seen the value of the Dharma, it's not too much. It doesn't seem, you know, non-equanimous at that time. We have to wrap up. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to be heading off to Asheville to look for a retreat home hermitage in the next couple of days. So wish, you know, think of me in your prayers occasionally. Thank you.
So before we do our dedications, the first thing I'd like to do is apologize that I know it's been warm in here and we're absolutely packed to the gills. But to use that as a springboard to remind everyone that Starting in April, we're going to actually shift to 2 Sunday morning services to help deal with the crowds that we've been getting, which is a wonderful problem to have. So there will be services at 9 o'clock and then the same service again at 10:45. So next weekend, however, there are no regular Sunday morning programs. That's Easter weekend. We're having a special Lam Rim reading retreat here in the center the whole weekend, so it's closed for the people who registered for that retreat to read the entire Lam Rim.
Wow.
Yeah. and then I'd also like to thank, on behalf of Venerable George, on the behalf of the center, of all of our students, I got several emails from people who are so grateful that you were here, that you accepted a last-minute invitation to teach. So I'm sure that, especially on their behalf, that we hope that you can return again soon
and
perhaps teach us again.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you. Bonk.
And we have one last request. We have a potluck that's set out, and so if you wouldn't mind saying a little blessing for the food.
Sure, sure. Should we say now?
We usually say it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Om Ma. May we and those around us never be separated from the 3 jewels of refuge in all our lifetimes. May we always make offerings to the triple gem and always receive their blessings. Bon appétit.
So if you turn to the white prayer book.
Well, start by reading the prayers on the pink sheet at the top. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil or befall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be free. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snowland teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion. To the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age. The one with great patience, the name Avatara. The one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void. Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Mandana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the 3 jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please live. Om Taditu Taditu De Soha. Om Taditu Taditu De Soha. Om Taditu Taditu De Soha. Om Taditu Taditu Re 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 Soha.